Welcome to the Popcorn Talk Network, for the online broadcast network that features movie discussion, news, and interviews. Press one.
Popcorn Talk. We talk movies. In a world where action movies are constantly exploding at the box office, our heroes take on the monumental task of dissecting and analyzing all aspects of action movies to truly understand what it takes to make a great action film. Ben Bateman, Andrew Guy, in a Popcorn Talk Network exclusive, this is Action Movie Anatomy.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to the show! Welcome to Action Movie Anatomy on this lovely Wednesday afternoon. Oh my god, it's exciting. Listen to the music. That's not what I'm hearing.
It's like Terminator.
Yeah, it's so good. Oh my goodness, it's sweet.
I love this movie.
There's nothing quite like Hans Zimmer in the afternoon.
There's not, my friend.
Mid-90s Hans Zimmer in the afternoon! This is Action Movie Anatomy, guys. Welcome to the show. This is Action Movie Anatomy on the Popcorn Talk Network, the online broadcast network dedicated to talking movies and all things movie-related. My name is Ben Bateman. I'm your host, joined today by my suave, lovely-dressed co-host, complete with a tie clip today, Mr. Andrew Guy! What's up, everybody? Yes! Let's do this, man. Hi, it's me. I'm here. This movie is so perfect for this show.
Oh, it's so sweet.
It's like almost the best one we've done, like, that fits our categories.
This movie is like a forgotten classic in the sense that, like, if you really want, we're always talking about The Rock. Yeah. We use The Rock as our like benchmark movie. You always want to hit the movie that, like, feels the most like watching The Rock, just in tone. In tone, this might be the closest movie we've done on the show to date.
Yeah.
It just has, like, I mean, not to mention that the score is pretty much identical, but it's like a year removed from it. It's Bruckheimer and Don Simpson. It just feels awesome.
Maybe all that you need to do to be on our show is to have Zimmer do your soundtrack and then have Bruckheimer produce it.
Yeah, I mean, all those other movies they did around the same time, it's like, for instance, Face Off and Con Air are great.
Yeah.
They're awesome movies. By the way, we're doing Crimson Tide, if you guys didn't know already.
If you can't read the bottom third there.
I hadn't introduced it. But, like, there's just, those movies are awesome, they're just not the same. Like,
yes.
They're cornier in some ways, they don't quite hold together. Like, this movie dramatically holds together really well.
There's not many moments in this movie, if any, where you don't feel like this is just real. It's just a real, like, good, honest, I mean,
yeah.
That's why I think this movie toes the line of being totally legitimate and ridiculously legitimate, which we will get to later.
Yeah. Yeah, because I think, and I also think there's a certain quality that's added to police procedurals and military procedurals and courtroom procedurals to some degree if they're done with music like this, directors like this, and producers like that.
Right.
Because it's all very by the book, and it's all seems very accurate.
Can you confirm? I confirm.
Yeah.
I confirm.
Yeah, it's so awesome. I love this movie. Anyway, guys, Action Movie Anatomy, we talk about movies on the show. Usually those movies adhere to four basic rules, aside from being made after 1981, which is kind of a loose rule. We haven't broken it yet, but it's just kind of there. Rule number one, the hero and the villain always play... No, the hero always plays by his own rules. Or her rules. Number two, the hero and the villain are always the smartest people or things or beings or creatures in the room. Rule number three, the movie is driven by a police, military, political, or mercenary figure. When we say political, we mean they either could be the man or work for the man. So they could be
an MT officer from the movie Taking of Pelham 123.
Very
which
good, sir.
Also is a Tony Scott and Denzel masterpiece.
And lastly, rule number four, the movie contains a minimum of one explosion. You just called Taking of Pelham 123 a masterpiece, and I glazed over it. That's amazing.
I was hoping that he was going to leave it back there in the dust.
Mark, can you roll that as a clip? Just record that for us. That's very important for
Mark,
the show.
Please don't.
Damn him. Damn that man. All right, guys. This is the trailer for Crimson Tide, and I have to say... Well, before we watch the trailer for Crimson Tide, actually, I should remind everybody, if you want to talk to Andrew about his sweet colored shirt, you can find him at...
Oh, you can find me at Andrew Guy.
You can find me at Ben Bateman Media. And, of course, follow the podcast. We now have an Action Movie Anatomy podcast Twitter at AMA Podcast on Twitter. So follow us there. Tweet, like, subscribe, iTunes, YouTube, all that. It helps us stay high in the standings.
It's the only way for you guys to vote on what movie we're going to do next week. You got to get it.
Yeah,
you got to follow us.
We like live conversations. We are going to pitch next week's movies, and you get to vote on them specifically. So you guys have been great about that. Follow us on Twitter to know what we do. Let's watch the trailer for Crimson Tide right now.
So good.
So good.
In a world.
Yeah.
As you no doubt heard, my exo has appendicitis. Your name was at the top of the list.
Love the music.
That's good to know, sir.
was short list.
There's trouble in Russia. So they called us. And we're going over there and bringing the most lethal killing machine ever devised.
The last time we hit this state of emergency was 32 and a half years ago during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
I don't even want to talk. That's
what it's all about,
gentlemen. Right now. I know. That's one of my favorite lines.
Diving officers, submerge the ship, make a depth 150 feet.
On the 1MC, dive.
This year,
we have a properly formatted emergency
what we've always known.
What we've always known.
I love this guy's voice.
Yeah, it's so classic.
Becomes what we've always feared.
Gentlemen, this is the captain. Russian rebels have threatened to launch against our country and are fueling right now. This is not a drill.
Sweaty Vigo.
No.
Denzel.
Yeah, everyone is always sweating in this movie.
A lot of artificial sweat. A lot of spray bottles.
That's a message from. Yeah, when Denzel's like running around and fighting shirtless, you can just see that it's clearly just like droplets all over him.
There's no place for fear. There's no place for fear. Get this
one wrong. There's no room for mistakes.
If we launch and we're wrong, what's left of Russia is going to launch at us.
I'm captain of this boat. I don't have to think this over.
There's no time for doubt.
The missile system's ready to launch in 6 minutes.
You repeat this order or I'll find somebody who will.
Hell no, you won't, sir.
And nothing can stop the tide.
Nothing can stop the tide.
Oh, it's so intense.
Hey, it's the only action scene in the whole movie.
Oh, that scene was heartbreaking.
Dude, Zahn?
I forgot that. Yeah, oh. I forgot.
Ow!
So good!
Crimson Tide.
God, that movie's sweet. It's so good.
If you're wrong, if I'm wrong, then we're at war.
God help us all.
God help us all.
Man, I cannot get over the chemistry of the two of them.
Oh my God.
It is magnetic.
I also can't get over how good the trailer is. Like, okay, you go back to 03, and most of the trailers in 03 are less compelling than that trailer.
The 99, the Matrix one, yeah, is atrocious. Terrible. Compared to this.
You go back to 95, 96, like, I immediately queued up the trailer for The Rock after this.
Right.
Immediately. Just to see, like, The Rock must have a sweet
You also
trailer.
Watched the trailer for Art of War, didn't you?
Also sweet. Also sweet. I don't believe we've met.
We still have
it. We still have it. Then sell, like, a fake beard, like a turban or something. Snipes.
Yeah.
So that trailer is just excellent. Like, the way that it starts, one of my favorite lines in the whole trailer is, like, it introduces everything. It's real intense, and you have the choir music playing.
Yeah.
And I love when Denzel's like, the last time we hit the state of emergency was 32 years ago on the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah.
So this is what it's all about, gentlemen. This is what we trained for. And you're like, oh my God, it's so exciting.
I just love the, you were the top of my list.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, sir. It was a short list.
Yeah.
Just, like, immediately you can tell the tension.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so good.
The chemistry with those two is really wonderful. I mean,
just incredible. I mean, it's excellent. What makes the movie as good as it is.
Because most of the action, in fact, the 99% of the action takes place in conversations between
It's like a courtroom
two.
Drama
yeah.
action movie or something.
100%.
Yeah.
So that was the trailer for Crimson Tide. Now, normally we would do action movie tagline. We thought we would skip over it today because we didn't want the segment to become a little bit stale.
Yeah.
There's too much to talk about with this movie that is too entertaining.
It's one of those episodes where I just want to, like, throw this whole thing away and just be like, how fucking sweet was
yeah,
this movie?
Yeah, yeah,
you know
yeah,
what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah. And, like, well, we will cover the production stuff. We always do. But, like, I look back at some of the episodes, some of my favorite episodes, and it's mostly just, like, us digging around quoting lines.
Right.
Like, Predator is, like, arguably my favorite movie, favorite episode we've ever done. And
yeah.
most of that episode is us just being like, God, they're so sweet when they get out of the helicopter.
Yeah.
Look at his muscles, Arnold lean.
Dude, speaking of muscles, Denzel boxing in this movie.
Young Denzel
pretty
looking jacked.
Shredded.
Talk about a guy. He's like Cruise in the sense that he's been famous now in 4 decades. Like,
mm-hmm.
you know, he's been a movie star in 4 decades.
He's gone through the ups and downs just like Cruise of, like, different characters and types that he's expected to play.
Yeah, so we'll get into him, actually, I guess, in just 1 second. But we should cover a couple things here. Thesis and Fist Pump before
Absolutely.
We do.
Absolutely.
So this is an interesting one for Thesis. I love movies like this because it's such a simple movie
mm-hmm.
in so many ways. It feels so awesome to watch. It offers so much as an action movie. But because the ideas – it's one location. It's war. It's the Russians. It's like the ideas are so clearly distilled, and it's like peace, war.
Right.
You can get a lot of really interesting thoughts out
yeah,
of this.
Yeah, I mean, like, the things that are in this movie, it's peace, war, black, white, like – above water, below. Like, it's everything's very black and white.
Yeah.
Cut and dry.
The world ends or it doesn't.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it's executed perfectly. And I'm going to jump in with my thesis after you describe what it is, because I want everyone to know what we're talking about here.
Yeah, so unless, in case you're a first-time viewer, this is the part in the show where we bring an idea to the table, something we've constructed out of this movie, a really strong opinion. This is something often rooted in hyperbole. It should be, this is the greatest this ever, or this is the first time this has ever happened, or this is the most this that's ever been done by this person, something like that. Not necessarily the truth, but statement of fact by you. And that is what thesis statement is. So,
all right. So mine is, I mean, other than like, this is something we talk about because we love Tony Scott so much on this movie. This is like the least Tony Scott movie ever, other than like True Romance.
Yeah, that'd be the one.
But for me, my thesis statement is this is the greatest non-action movie ever made.
Because there's literally
literally no action in this movie at all. But the whole time, it feels like you're a Navy SEAL on the way to the Rock in the Rock. It's that build. It's that energy. Like nothing even needs to happen. You know what I mean? Like, just the two of them alone is so good. Like, this is not an action movie, but it is so perfect for the show, and it is such a great action movie. It's weird.
It's like one of those indicators where we always talked about at the beginning of the show. What we were looking for is tone.
Tone.
And you can actually get tone out of a lot of places, which is why, like, in a lot of ways, like Tombstone, the tone of that movie is closer to our show than a lot of other Westerns. Right. Yet it is still a Western. And that's why this movie works so well. It's great actors. It's Oscar-winning actors squaring off against each other in a Bruckheimer, Don Simpson, Tony Scott action movie.
Right.
With big cliches and big fist pumps. Like, huge score.
The scene where all the guys, when they find out that the Russian commander has surrendered, it's like, yeah!
Everybody's cheering, patting each other on the back.
Except Hackman and Denzel.
Oh, it's so good. All right, so my thesis statement is this. This is the most tasteful handling of racism in a Bruckheimer-Simpson film to date.
I love it. I didn't even think you needed to put Bruckheimer Simpson, like, I don't think ever, but like, for an action movie, this is incredibly well done. It's so subtle and it's so intelligent.
I would have said big budget action, but I think that it's ignorant on my part to make the statement, not necessarily knowing in other countries or in other eras if there was a movie that at the time was a big budget movie that handles it really well. I'm sure there are other great examples. Mm-hmm. I can think of a lot of examples of dramas that do it well, but the fact that this movie was released within 3 years surrounding Bad Boys, Face Off, The Rock, Con Air, just a few years before Gone in 60 Seconds. I mean, like,
it was like movies were transitioning to a different type of action movie.
Yeah, this was the transition from the success of Top Gun in 86, followed by all these other movies, all these other Don Simpson, Jerry Bruckheimer movies. By the time the mid-90s hit, it was like, the formula and the budget was there. So now it's like, okay, who can we get? Who's the biggest Oscar winner or the biggest name who can, you know, put butts in seats? And so I think it's really pretty miraculous how subtle the script handles racial tension in this movie, and the fact that it's 95, so long ago to do it so well.
It's ahead of its time, and it's beautifully done, whether it's the disapproving looks that that Gene Hackman gives the back of Denzel's head so many times.
Yeah.
When he says something, he kind of like looks over at him, just like, don't.
Yeah.
Don't talk, you know, and then the beginning, the short list, and the end, that is almost my favorite line, but it's not, but it's just beautifully written.
Yeah.
When he's talking about the horses from Portugal, he's like, I know they're from Portugal or they're all white.
Yeah.
He's like, well, they're from Spain and they're born black.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, I didn't know that. He's that smug look on his face. You just want to hit him in the face. I didn't know that. But they are from Portugal.
Yeah, the scene when he brings Denzel into his quarters, and he's like, a few things. Yeah. And he's like, don't question me in front of the men. These are kids out there. They're being asked to do an unthinkable thing.
He's patronizing the shit out of him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just awesome. Like, I love it. I just love this movie. All right, so that's my thesis statement. And the reason I say it is just like, as you said, that scene is done so well. Even scenes earlier, it's so clear. It's so in the air at all times. You can't help but notice. And one of the things about this movie I love so much, and we'll get into this in Fist Pump Moment because this directly relates to my Fist Pump Moment. So, in fact, maybe I'll lead into that and we'll talk about it then.
Can I jump in really quick?
Oh, yeah,
I have a quick thing that I was thinking, and the reason I'm saying this is because I want the audience, tweet at us, please, me or Ben, because I have a question for you guys, and I meant to look this up. The first time that Denzel and Hackman meet, they talk about how he's into horses, he's a horseman.
Yeah.
And he mentions a specific horse.
Arabian horse.
Hackman. Yeah, yeah. Is there a reason behind? Is there something about an Arabian horse that I don't know? Because that moment for me,
yeah.
I felt racial undertones, but I didn't know why. And then later on at the end when they have that other conversation about the Portugal horse and it's much more in your face, I wondered if back then I was like, there had to have been something I missed.
So Hackman says, what's the best horse you ever rode?
Right. Arabian.
And he says Arabian. Arabian horses are very expensive and they're very they're beautiful and they're elegant. They're not like sort of your common I don't know, you know, your common Hackman says, just give me a something.
Right, yeah, like an old.
A very common, yeah. Like sort of like a cowboy horse.
Exactly.
And so the idea being that he's like, well, I'm the old cowboy white
old,
guy.
Old money, old school, go Bama, like that type of thing. Like, yeah. Is that what
he's
it
like,
is?
And he's like, you're the black young gun who's coming in here from Harvard.
In Harvard, yeah.
And you know, it's like, okay. you think of yourself as high society riding a nice horse. But, you know, I'm the boss. I'm the boss. I don't care what school you went to. I don't care how trained you are. I don't care what kind of horse you ride. You know, it's that. I think
that's,
it's getting it.
No,
that.
I think that's exactly what it is. So never mind. Don't tweet. Put your phone away.
Yeah. Or if you have thoughts on it. I mean, obviously, you know, it's two people's interpretation of something, a subject that is laden with history and controversial opinion. So please share them with us because it's very interesting. So
yes.
The next section on the show is called Fist Bump Moment. And this is a movie that is made for Fist Bump Moment.
Yes.
I mean, Fist Bump Moment is that time when you're sitting on the couch and you're like, you're watching the movie and you're sitting there, maybe having a drink or something. Something happens. You're like, yes. You look around. You're like, is anybody else seeing this right now? Are you watching this? If nobody's in the room, you maybe get the phone. You're like,
your phone. Hello?
Andrew, have you seen Crimson Tide? Seriously, go back and watch Crimson Tide. Oh, there's this one part.
22 minutes, 17 seconds in. Trust me.
You like do the line for your buddy or like maybe your roommate's in the next room like eating with his girlfriend. You're like, get in here. You need to watch this. That's what your fist bump moment is. And so this movie has so many of them.
And that's what it's like to be Ben's friend and roommate.
Yeah, pretty much. I made fist bump moment. You can't tell.
You did, yeah. There's so many sweet ones in this movie.
Okay, so this is what I was going to say. And this is why I want to get at. It relates to my last one.
Okay.
So, okay. Mark, cue up the speech if you can. The Gene Hackman speech. We have a pretty low res version, I think, here to show. But you'll get the idea. Hackman delivers this fucking awesome speech.
Oh, it's so good.
There's trouble in Russia.
I just want to watch it, but...
So they called us.
Okay, we will just watch it, because it's so good.
He's so good.
We're going over there.
It really swells when the score picks up behind it.
No killing machine ever devised. We're capable of launching more firepower.
There's a famous coach, Alabama coach, named Bear. His name is Bear, something Bear, something. That's why his ship's the Alabama, his dog's name is Bear.
Okay. I like that. Denzel's smile when he realizes like how fun it's going to be. It's so good.
The front line and the last line of defense.
The rain.
I expect and demand your very best.
Love him.
Anything less? You should have joined the Air Force.
The comedy, it's classic.
Yeah, it's perfect. Yeah.
Here's music.
This might be our commander-in-chief's navy.
This is my boat. This is our Independence Day.
And if you can't, that strange sensation you'll be feeling in the seat of your pants will be my boot in your ass.
I love this age for Hackman. Conniving.
This movie makes me want to go watch all of his films.
So many good ones in between. I mean, going back all the way to the 60s,
oh,
but
yeah.
70s Hackman is awesome. 80s Hackman is awesome. Mm-hmm. 90s Hackman is awesome.
90s Hackman is amazing.
Tenenbaums, even. 2000s is awesome.
You're wearing the name of this ship, aren't you, Mr. Cobb?
Very aware, sir.
It bears a proud name, doesn't it, Mr. Cobb? Very proud, sir. It represents fine people. Very fine people, sir. You live in a fine...
On his job.
Yeah.
Outstanding, sir. In the greatest country in the entire world.
Alabama, sir.
And what is that name, Mr. Cobb?
Alabama, sir.
And what do we say?
Go, Bama. Go, Tide.
Dismiss the crew. Aye, aye, sir.
Okay. All right. So, go, Bama, roll Tide's absolutely my fist bump moment.
It's so sweet. Yeah. And we're both not Bama fans.
Yeah, not at all. But the reason that that's my fist bump moment, the thing I like so much about it, and the reason this relates to my thesis... That is indicative to me of
old
the
South.
Culture of the movie and the attitude that is represented by not just the Navy, not just Hackman's character, but it's like Alabama's this old storied program in the South. Old money, white guys. Mm-hmm. Like, it's – there's always like sort of like a racial undertone when you talk about that part of the world. And so it's like Denzel is this Harvard guy who comes in to the situation. And I love that the end of such a serious address to the troops.
Right.
It's a football address.
Absolutely.
It's go Bama, roll Tide, because it's military. It's dudes. Dudes drink beer on Sundays and watch football. They watch college football on Saturdays. And like, it's just – it's just like so old.
The painting of the two worlds is so perfect.
That's why. So that is my fist bump moment for sure. I also think in some ways it's the most interesting sequence in the movie. It's the most interesting line. This movie is fascinating for that reason to me.
Yeah, I love it. All right. So what I want to do real quick after I mention my fist pump moment is I want to talk about all the other fist pump moments that are honorable mentions, because there's so many. But my fist pump moment is it's right after Vigo turns on Denzel.
Yeah.
He gives in. Webbs gives in finally after he tries so hard. You can tell he's an honorable dude, but he finally gives in. He's the only hope. Webbs, you're the only one. The captain said we needed you.
He's lost his nerve.
So he switches, right? And then when Denzel gets out and he gets on the phone, he goes, Webbs, you know. And
don't
then,
do it, Webbs. Don't do it.
And then, again, he says it, Webbs, you're the only one that can save us. Like, you're the only one that can. He gets put right in the middle of it again. He's made to make this decision two times in a row. Can he wrong, or can he do what he's done, can he right his wrong?
And Webbs looks down at the seaman who looks up at him, and he's like, get back to your station!
Yeah, it's so good. And then he just stands there and he smokes his cigarette as Hackman comes in. My fist pump moment is absolutely the phone call from Denzel to Vigo. It's so good.
So good.
What are your honorable mention fist pumps?
Oh, dude, there's so many good ones. Like, my favorite line is one of them, so I'll save it for later.
Okay.
That's absolutely one of them. I really, really love when he finally takes the ship from Hackman, because Hackman's trying to go for it. And he says, Lock, Captain Ramsey, in his, and then like, Cobb goes, come on, sir. He goes, do it now, Cobb!
Yeah.
Now, Cobb!
So
like,
good.
He's like, yes, sir. And like, it's just, I don't know, man. This movie is just full of sweet moments.
I love that first moment when Denzel has to make a call.
Yeah.
And it's to kill those guys, to basically let them drown.
Yeah.
See, we lose them or we lose the whole ship. You know, he's like, shut that door! You've been given your orders! Shut your mouth! Do it! And then you see Zahn still trying, boom, and he gets hit with that thing. So gnarly, but so sweet.
And he closes the thing and he's like, cabin secured, sir!
Oh, God, this movie's good.
Yeah.
It's amazing. All right, those are our two honorable mentions. We can move on.
So your fist bump moment, you shared yours absolutely.
It's 100% that call.
Okay, gotcha. I love it. All right, so that takes care of thesis and fist pump. God, this movie's sweet. Mark, I know you just watched it last night. Mark, for those of you listening, is our producer who's working the booth. And yeah, did you have particularly a fist pump moment, one moment that stuck out for you? Oh, yeah.
He's a good captain.
Yeah,
absolutely,
so sweet,
man.
So sweet. All right, so let's let's jump a little bit into where these guys were in their careers, because they were very much on opposite ends of the spectrum when this movie came out. For Denzel, his three most recent films he had done prior to this were Philadelphia in 1993. He had done The Pelican Brief in 1993 and Much Ado About Nothing in 1993. He was very much a star. At this point, he had already done Malcolm X. At this point, he had already done Glory. He had already done Devil in a Blue Dress. I mean, Philadelphia was a huge movie, so he's very much a movie star by 95.
Right, but he's not Denzel yet.
But I think he was just becoming Denzel.
Right.
Because he hadn't been like, ageless and timeless for a decade yet. He was in his first decade. This is sort of like right as his star was where it was, because I think I want to say The Hurricane is like 4 years later, and he wins the Oscar for Training Day like 7 or 8 years after this. So that later part of Remember the Titans, I think, is like 99, 98, 99, somewhere in there.
I feel like this is the beginning of just like, I mean, even with Philadelphia, that's more Tom Hanks than anything.
Exactly, yeah.
But like, this movie is kind of one of those moments of like, both these guys have just enough going on. You know what I mean? Like, Gene Hackman, he's not slowing down, but it's not the same type of star power that you get from a leading man. I think that the casting of this was just perfect.
Yeah, Hackman was getting put into movies like The Firm in 94, or he ended up doing, you know, as we said, by the time he did Tenenbaums, which is truthfully only like 7 or 8 years after this, that's where you can sort of see he's like kind of at the end of his rope.
Yeah,
he's Runaway Jury, I want to say it's like 03.
He had Enemy of the State in 95.
I think it's 99, but yeah, that's like, yeah, that's like right.
Or yeah, 99.
That's like right as he's getting to the tail end of his like, I can still do this part of his career.
Yeah.
So, and this is, you know, but I love this part of his career in particular, because French Connection 71, I think, unless mm-hmm. I'm mistaken, you know, that's, I mean, that's 24 years before this movie. And French Connection is when he's the guy. I mean, Unforgiven. He won the Oscar for Unforgiven.
That
was 3 years
was that,
before
92?
This.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, he is very – this is like the sort of – what's the word I'm looking for? His swan song kind of, his final sort of decade of
right.
awesome where he's getting those, you know, those premiere roles. I know they wanted Beatty for this. They wanted Warren Beatty for this role.
Could have been good, but yeah. Hackman's perfect.
Yeah, they had talked to him. So Hackman just kills it. So Hackman, The Quick and the Dead, 95, Wyatt Earp in 94, and then Geronimo, an American Legend in 93. Funny that he was in Wyatt Earp in 94 after winning the Oscar for Unforgiven in 92.
Yep.
Wyatt Earp.
Same year, or the year after Tombstone.
Wasn't the same or the next year?
I thought it was the next year, but
yeah,
whatever.
Within a year of it, though. Yeah, I mean, like, definitely not, none of those three movies register for people as classics.
Mm-hmm.
This doesn't register for people as a classic, but the...
Which is weird because this movie is such a classic when you go back and I think it gets overshadowed a lot by K-19.
Or
I mean, excuse me, The Hunt for Red October.
Hunt for October,
yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
absolutely.
That's kind of the submarine movie.
Totally.
You know what I mean? There's Das Boot, and there's K-19, there's U-571.
Right.
But Crimson Tide and The Hunt for Red October are the two, but Red October is, like, far and away much more recognized than this.
Which is interesting. We will do Red October on the show 100% at some point. I like Red October a lot. I think that movie's really sweet.
I don't remember it at all.
It's really compelling. I don't think it's as sweet as this, though. Like, it's a better movie in the sense that it's sort of more timeless. Oh, we still have to do The Edge! I just remember we haven't done that movie yet! Oh my god. So excited. Just hit me that we hadn't done that movie yet.
I know. I just thought that The Hunted just popped in my head. I really want to do that.
Benicio?
And Tommy Lee?
Yeah. Love Tommy
so
Lee.
So good.
But anyway, that's pretty much where these guys were in their career. We can move on.
Yeah, this is an interesting production development because we've talked about Tony Scott before. We've talked about Simpson and Bruckheimer, but we know there's first-time viewers. We gotta pay the respect to these guys anyway. But the writers of this film are basically nobodies. You got Michael Schiffer and Richard P. Henrich, who – Henrich is a novelist, and he's known for being like an expert of naval fiction.
Yeah.
I think that's why he was brought on for this film, because he's literally done nothing else.
Yeah.
He's written no other films. He wrote a TV story or TV film called Counter-Strike, I believe.
Yeah. Like 02, I think.
Yeah. And then he's written like, you know, over 10 books. He's written like almost 20 books. He lives in St. Louis. He's not in the business anymore. Not a lot to talk about. Same with Schiffer. Schiffer is an interesting guy. He did Colors and Lean on Me, and then he did this film.
Yeah.
And I think people kind of felt that he knew what he was doing.
Yeah.
But then he did Four Feathers and The Peacemaker, and I think he just retired. Either that or I don't think anyone wanted to work with him anymore.
Yeah.
So he went on to write video games, like
yeah.
the script for video games, and he penned the beginning, the first two Call of Duties, and
yeah.
also Call of Duty Finest Hour.
Yeah.
Which, if you play the Call of Duty games, they're amazing. But it's just interesting, like, to have
yeah.
those people that wrote such a good script.
Well, I think Colors, when I was talking about other films that I can think of that handle the subject of racial tension and racism and prejudice well,
mm-hmm.
Colors was actually one of the movies in my head.
Okay.
And it probably was put there by when we were doing the research for the seeing it and it coming to mind. But it's much more heavy-handed. I mean, the fucking movie's called Colors.
Yeah, exactly.
Like it's really good, but like that's a little bit in my face. Lean on Me is a really good movie.
Yeah.
Like, those are both well-respected. Colors and Lean on Me. Peacemaker's a weird movie.
It's a weird – wasn't that – is it Kidman and Clooney?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it gets – it's Clooney just before he's Clooney.
Yeah.
Like it's right a year before – I want to say it's like a year before Batman and it's like a year before Three Kings. He was like transitioning
from
the same
ER,
time as,
right?
Out of Sight.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, you know, he was a guy that people bought the brand, but it wasn't like George Clooney yet. And so it just gets kind of dismissed.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say Peacemaker is directed by somebody relevant.
It's not a very good movie. I remember watching it. It's not horrible,
yeah.
but it's just not very good.
And then Four Feathers is like a period piece that just people get – it gets forgotten. Highlight of the movie is that if you love Heath Ledger, he's in that movie.
Yes, he's very good.
So then Tony Scott. Tony Scott is just a gangster. Like
he's a hero on the – I mean there's a few people that we talk about on this show.
Yep.
And Tony Scott's one of them. Tom Cruise, Denzel. Like these are our boys.
Yeah, Tony Scott, we've often...
Bruce Berman.
Yeah, Bruce Berman. Bruce Berman, the berm. We've often said about Tony Scott that his finest work are the movies that he uses Denzel Washington. This was their first collaboration. Mm-hmm. He went on after this movie to reunite with him in 03 for Man on Fire, and then three more times subsequently with Deja Vu, The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, and Unstoppable. Many people would say this is the best film they did together, yeah. or Man on Fire. Those other three are not very well respected, but they made enough money. Interesting here is that the other four movies have a very distinct style. A style that he started to really move towards in the mid part of the 2000s.
I mean, he's one of the most stylized directors out there.
And this movie, there's some weird stylistic stuff where he's doing the tilt, the camera tilt.
Yeah, and we've talked about this, and the first time that we watched this film together was right before we even started the show.
Yeah.
And I hadn't seen it in so long that I didn't remember anything about it. It really bothered me the first time I watched it.
Yeah.
Like, it just seemed cheap and tacky, and it was not doing what it intended to do.
Yeah.
This second time around, it's not as bad.
Yeah.
It didn't bother me as much. You called it out at one point, and I was like, oh, yeah, there it is again.
And it's just to try to simulate, like, being in a moving submarine. It's just very, like, everything about this movie is, like, super intense.
Yeah.
Which is, like, kind of what the movie is supposed to be about.
Which is so funny because the best part about it is its subtleties.
Yeah, it has, like, basically almost no action. So, Tony Scott, is responsible for a number of movies you'd know. The ones we just mentioned, as well as the fact that his first Bruckheimer-Don Simpson collaboration, or within his first couple, was Top Gun in 1986.
Yeah.
Which I believe he went on to do Beverly Hills Cop 2.
Yep.
He did True Romance in 94, which was a Tarantino script. He's done a ton of movies. Enemy of the State. He's the younger brother of Ridley Scott. Never got the critical acclaim that Ridley got.
Mm-hmm.
Was just kind of never in the same category in most people's minds. But there's that great quote, right, that we had here.
Yeah, and I think that every single time that we talk about Denzel Washington and Tony Scott, which we can only do two more times, unfortunately, on the show, Betsy Sharkey from the Los Angeles Times wrote this, and Ben, you can read it. I think that it's beautiful, and I think it completely sums up their relationship on film.
Yeah, yeah. So she says of Denzel and Tony Scott, and she says, Scott was at his best when Washington was in the picture. The characters the actor played are the archetype of the kind of men Scott made. At their core, and what guided all the actions that followed, was a fundamental decency. They were flawed men, to be sure, some more than others, but men who accorded a dignity to anyone who deserved it. And it's awesome because it's like, when we talk about Denzel, I've used the phrase the noble savage before.
Yep.
It's like he's just got this, he'll get his hands dirty if he has to.
Right.
But he wants to live according to honor and respect.
I mean, he got pushed to the point where he's like, no, you will not, sir. And then he takes over the ship because
to the limit.
There's nowhere else to go. He will not break the rules to do what is right.
Yeah.
But the moment that he knows that he can do what's right with backing, he jumps on it.
Right. So, okay, like jumping back to the writers for a second, there's a scene in this movie where Denzel and Hackman are facing off in a mess hall about the nature of war. Mm. And so they hired Robert Towne. Robert Towne, for those of you that don't know, is one of the most esteemed screenwriters of all time. His crowning achievement is the fact that he wrote Chinatown, along with like just at least a dozen other movies, a ton of really good ones, very memorable movies. They called Robert Towne because they needed a rewrite and they wanted the scene to really hit. And they got him to essentially narrate a rewrite of the scene over the phone in an emergency within a day of shooting the actual scene.
Yeah.
And it's one of the most poignant scenes of the film where Denzel in the end says, well, sir, I believe that the nature of war or the enemy is war itself.
Yeah.
And Denzel is just like so like –
or Hackman. He
hates it.
Because all Hackman knows is war.
Yeah.
And like you can't reason with him. It's literally an unstoppable force meeting an immovable object with the two of these guys.
Yeah. It's what's the line? It is that war is an extension of politics by other means, which is what they end up discussing. So I think that's really cool. There was another couple rewrites that people brought in. Tarantino, actually.
Is the most interesting of all of them, which is funny because he just did this on True Romance.
Yeah, so he had sold the script for True Romance. Tony Scott directed it. People loved the movie. It did really well. So the next year when they're making this movie, Tarantino gets hired to come in and do some rewrites. And it's the pop culture references in the script, the Silver Surfer references, right. The Star Trek references.
Which is also a fist pump moment of mine.
Yeah.
He's like, no, anybody that has read the comics knows.
Yeah.
And that's when you get it. It's like, oh, okay, this guy's cool.
It's so he's corny, cool but it's so awesome. Yeah. So those are Tarantino lines. I heard a story.
It's so effective is what it is.
I heard a story that when Tarantino came on set, Denzel confronted him in front of the full cast and crew about his use of the N-word in his films. Just to do it.
Just like, hey, man, just been wondering.
Yeah, and it made Tarantino extremely uncomfortable to the point that he was like, can we talk about this in a more private setting? And Denzel was like, no, we can talk about it in front of everybody. And then later on, Denzel has gone on record to say, I still believe Tarantino is a fine artist. So, like, he respects him, but I just thought that was cool.
Denzel seems like the type of guy where if he wants a question answered, and Tarantino's basically a nobody at this point,
yeah,
he's going to ask him, and you're going to answer his question right then. Doesn't mean he doesn't respect it. It's one of those things where if you're going to do it, make it worthwhile. Yeah. Make it matter. Don't just have it there to have it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Because Tarantino's character in Pulp Fiction the year before actually says the word several times.
Yeah.
In a pretty rough manner.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to say that word in not a rough manner.
Yeah, I would say so. Anyway, I thought that was pretty cool. As far as the producers go, I mean, once again, if you're a new viewer or listener, Bruckheimer and Don Simpson are sort of – there's an upper echelon of producers on this type of film.
Yeah.
I mean, those two, if you go and look up the IMDb for Bruckheimer and Simpson has since passed. But, I mean, oh, and speaking of which, Tony Scott has also passed. We didn't mention that he committed suicide several years ago. But
rest in peace, brother.
Yeah, 100%. I actually just spoke with – I'm just jumping all over the place. But at the SAG Awards, I got to interview Kevin Dunn, who is the principal in Warrior. He's the dad in Transformers. Yeah. A lot of people know his face. And I started talking about Tony a little bit because he's in – Unstoppable.
Yes.
He's unstoppable with him. And he was like, God, that was so sad. He's like, what an artist. What a great, great talent. You know, he just had such a sense of light and framing. And it was fun to hear somebody who had worked with him and really missed him talk about him a little bit.
But always wearing his baseball cap, just down to earth, hardworking guy.
I've heard good stories about him. Yeah, our friend Anthony, who was on here for the Warrior episode, who wrote Warrior, had met with him about working on some projects before he passed as well, and had some great things to say about him. Extremely hospitable, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, and to get back into Bruckheimer and Simpson, just go and look at what they did. This is, again, one of those situations that we talk about on the show where, like, you get someone like James Cameron as a producer, not the director, but when he's producing stuff. Same with Bruckheimer and who's another one of the biggest action movies we talk about a
producers?
Lot.
I mean,
Black.
Silver.
Or Silver, excuse me.
Joel Silver or, like, I mean, somebody like Bruce Berman. Like,
yeah, just go and look because it'll be doing you a lot bigger favor than us talking about what they've done. But, you know, Pirates, Beverly Hills Cop, this movie, The Rock, like, he's... They've
Bad
got their
Boys,
hand in everything.
Armageddon. I mean, just tons of movies. The whole brand of movies, everything from like Gone in 60 Seconds to Face Off, Con Air, you know, as you said, Bad Boys, Days of Thunder. Like, there's all these movies that these guys produced. They were very formulaic to the point that people sort of resented the style.
Right.
Intelligent filmgoers.
You'd see that Bruckheimer Simpson thing at the beginning of a movie, and you'd be like, all right, well, let's see.
But in retrospect, it's aged in a way that is extremely entertaining and. I very much enjoy.
It's
a staple of our childhood.
Well, the thing that's so great about them is that they, and Bruckheimer mainly, is he's evolved. He always evolves with the changing times, and like that's why he can do The Rock and Armageddon and Bad Boys and then go and do the Pirates movies and do them well. You know what I mean?
Totally.
He knows where the thing is going, where the genre is going. This movie was... Yeah, we're going to get into our critical and box office section here, and this movie is critically acclaimed pretty well, but the numbers on it they're medium. I think lukewarm is like the best word to use for it. So the studio was Buena Vista. It cost $53 million to make, and it was released in May of 1995. Domestically, it made $91 million, so it almost doubled its budget domestically, which is great. And then worldwide, it made $66 million for a grand total of $157 million.
Yeah.
For a submarine movie in 95, tripling its budget, I think that's pretty great.
Yeah, it's rock solid.
You know,
it
opened at number one at $18 million, and it just kind of kept trucking along.
Yeah, it finished 11th. You can throw up the box office graphic here. I mean, it finished 11th domestically on the year.
Which this year, it's a tough year to compete with the movies that there are that's on here.
I mean, like, okay, Die Hard 3 finished ahead of it. Like, the fact that 7... I mean, as good of a movie as 7 is, as much as I like 7, it doesn't strike me as a movie that would have made more money in theaters than Crimson Tide. It seems more of a drama. It's kind of a slasher movie.
The other movies, though, they all seem to make sense.
Yeah. Maybe Ace Ventura 2, but people loved Ace Ventura 1.
Yeah, I mean, that was when Jim Carrey could literally do no wrong.
Yeah.
But first of all, just like going back, how far do we have all 25 of? Okay, just going back and looking at movies that came out in 95.
Yeah,
like when we do these with old box offices, like I love 90% of the movies on here.
Well, okay, does it? Do you find it strange that like when you talk about this is number 11 that year? I mean, scratching Waterworld, which is number 12, just because it's like a huge flop. But like the three movies that are listed after that, Dangerous Minds, Mr. Holland's Opus, and While You Were Sleeping.
Right.
Like I would have expected Crimson Tide to make significantly more money than those movies.
Right. But what about Braveheart and Congo and Heat?
Yeah, so sweet.
You know what I mean? Like it's
Outbreak, Mortal Kombat.
Yeah.
Grumpier Old Men.
Your soul is mine. Yeah, Grumpier Old Men. Which is – it's just like it's so crazy that when you go back and you look at box offices from that time, it just completely speaks to who we were as a society at that moment.
Would you guys watch an episode if we did Mortal Kombat 1 from 1995? Would you guys watch it? Tweet at us.
Yes.
Let us at AMA Podcast, at Ben Bateman Media, at Andrew Guy, or leave it in the comments. If we can get 20 people, unique tweets or comments telling us to do Mortal Kombat,
right,
it'll be like an emergency episode.
Oh, yeah. We'll do it because that movie is just – both – they're all so sweet. Oh, I love it.
Love that movie. That scene with the first scene with Johnny Cage.
Oh, yeah.
Where do you get these guys? This is the part where you fall down.
Yeah. And he, like, throws himself. Oh, I love it.
I want Kano.
I had to open up the live chat. Yeah. Why don't you get into Critical while I look over here and just see how many people are going to rave about Mortal Kombat real quick.
All right. So, let's see. Where did I put this? All right. So, for Critical, this movie got a 7.3 on IMDb. 7.3 is pretty good.
Yeah.
It's not amazing, but it's quite good. It's above average by a significant margin. Even like a 6.8 is reasonable. 7.1 is the baseline of pretty good. So 7.3 is respectable. 87, 92, 83 for all critics, top critics, and audience score on Rotten Tomatoes. I find it strange that top critics gave this movie a 92%. It doesn't seem like it's up their alley.
I know. I was looking at those numbers, and there was like something about it where I was just like, I don't know if the 92 and the 83 should be switched or if the two critics should be dropped like 30% or what it is. But it's something about it, when you look at these numbers as much as we do, just seems a little off.
Well, never in a million years would you expect a Bruckheimer Simpson movie with the kind of dialogue and the kind of scenes this movie has that the audience score would be the lowest of the three.
Right.
That's never the case.
Yeah, no. And I think it's maybe because it was advertised as a sweet action movie and there's no action in it.
And maybe it's more – it's considered by people to be more of a drama, even though to us it feels like more of an action movie.
So it looks like no one was quite as excited as we were.
No one.
One person mentioned only the first Mortal Kombat, please. That's the only thing they wrote.
Fair enough.
Whatever. Wow. We'll see what happens.
All right. Yeah. So this movie was nominated for 3 Oscars. Of course, they were all technical. He had film editing, best effects, and sound effects. Hans Zimmer, interestingly enough, won a Grammy for his score in this film. Yet.
Love it.
Was not nominated for an Academy Award for the same score. Only 5 times in history has that happened. This is one of the 5
times. We've talked about it before on the show with a different score, like a certain thing happening like that.
Dark Knight won the Grammy, was not nominated for an Oscar. A couple others come to mind, but I thought that was interesting. It's a great score. It really fits the movie well.
The best effects is funny to me because I think it's best effects, best sound effects,
yeah.
Which makes more sense because the effects, like the fact that they couldn't get permission from the Navy to show or to use their submarines
yeah.
on camera.
Yeah.
So they had to use that like really cheap cutaway of like a submarine like almost submerging like 5 times the
yeah.
first time they go down.
Yeah.
But that's also a sweet scene when he's up there smoking a cigar.
It's really good.
The very last time.
He's like, you didn't ruin it. You shut up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that.
Awesome. Yeah, yeah. Because that's an interesting part because the Navy wouldn't support this movie.
Yeah.
They didn't sign off on the idea of a mutiny on a Navy boat. And so Tony Scott had to like fly. It's within his legal rights to fly a helicopter above a submerging submarine and just film it. And they did it.
Genius.
Like a bunch of times. And then that's the shot that they used in the movie. It's real footage, but it's like of a real actually submerging
like
submarine.
Like just a normal, yeah.
The real USS Alabama.
Okay, it was the real one.
Yeah.
Wow.
I believe so, yeah.
I wasn't sure if they put that in like with effects or not, but that's – I love it. I love it. No, yeah. You can't do it. Cool. I'll just videotape you guys doing it. Save me a bunch of money and time.
And when they were like, fly, and they were like, get out of here. And he's like, no, they submerged. And he's like, that's what I wanted anyway. That's the shot I needed. So,
So Janet Maslin gives from the New York Times gives this movie a rotten review saying, isn't there something awfully satisfying about the throbbing missiles and cathartic explosions that constitute the film's main excitement? Maybe so, but nothing else here delivers a comparable thrill, which is so wrong. to me. I feel like the only – I feel like you could switch those two things and it would be 100% right.
Yeah, I guess I would agree with you
like
completely.
Because, like, the missiles and the explosions, I don't give a shit about that.
No.
Oh, torpedoes launched. They're not going to get sunk. Okay, I know they're not going to get sunk.
Full left. Yeah. Right or left. It's like, all right.
Release sweet. Countermeasures. Yeah.
Release – how many countermeasures do we have? Enough.
I – it's – and nothing else is comparable thrill. The only thrill in this movie is the conversations between Denzel and Hackman. Like, they're
and
feuding.
Oh, are they thrilling.
Oh, so good.
James Berardinelli of Real Views.
Yeah, you always love to do those.
Said, because of the contained environment, submarines make great settings for thrillers, with the throbbing of the engine sounding like a pulse. Crimson Tide is no exception. The atmosphere alone is sufficient enough to keep the audience on edge.
I just realized I picked two reviews with the word throbbing in both of them. I don't know why that's funny to me.
Word association, what is good about this movie? Throbbing. That's what comes to mind.
Equestrians.
I thought about this because when Matt Haggerty came on the first time when we did Air Force One, the very first episode, he talked about a trend of movies in the 90s where it was like, put everybody on X and see what happens.
Try to make them try to get out, essentially.
It starts with Die Hard, put them all in a building, let them off, put them on a bus and see what happens, put them in a submarine, see what happens. It's like put everybody in one location, pressure cook that location. And it was a formula that worked really well in a lot of these
every
movies.
Those movies you just mentioned, all of them, we're probably going to do on our show eventually.
Con Air,
Air Force One, Speed, what I mean? It's brilliant.
Yeah, it works. It works very, very well, and I think that's funny that he is able to point that out. So this next part of our show is favorite line. It's almost as sweet as fist bump. It's kind of the same thing.
Yeah.
And I've been saving my favorite line. I would have just used it as a fist bump honorable mention.
I can't – when you say it, it might pop in my head, but usually when you have a favorite line
– I say it so many times.
You scream it at me all week long.
Right. This is true.
What is it?
Okay. It's right here. It says – these captain minister, will you always travel on the wrong side of the border?
Damn him. Damn that man.
So it's when they're taking Captain Ramsey under the ship to lock him in his quarters. And he says, Captain Ramsey, on operating procedures governing the release of nuclear weapons, we cannot launch our missiles unless both you and I agree.
Yeah.
Like, that's my favorite line
so
of the whole
good.
Movie. Yeah, that's so sweet. I love that line, but I also love during the speech, which says, this might be your commander-in-chief's boat. Or no, this is – what's he say? But this is my ship.
Yeah, exactly.
Something like that. Yeah. Or his Navy. That's, I think, my other favorite line.
It's so good.
Really blew it on those lines just now.
We could do the whole show over again if you want.
Start it over.
My favorite line is said pretty early. Well, I have the real quick one is, get that radio fixed, Vossler. I could have built one by now.
Yeah.
I love that line, but
I need warp speed.
Yeah. We're here to preserve democracy, not practice it.
Yeah, it's a good line.
It's a good line, and it happens so early on in the movie. You can just tell. They do such a great job of painting the old XO with having never met him or hearing anything about him that I am pretty sure he's just a complete yes man that just shut his mouth and did everything that Hackman said.
Yeah, totally.
And you get it any time that Denzel even voices his opinion. You can see the annoyance on his face. So that line, for me, just sums up perfectly like the relationship that he's going to have with his XO. It's not out of respect.
But the men love Hackman. They love Ramsey.
They do.
They respect him.
Well, half of them, they all love him.
Yeah.
That's true. They all love him, but I think half of them know he's just batshit. You can't just blow up another country because you want to,
I mean, as it said at the end of the movie, both of their actions were consistent with, moral obligations, but not necessarily with preserving the safety of the country because he got the order to launch, and what if they had waited for the confirmation and
all the other submarines were gone? And,
that's why it's an interesting movie, and that's when I'm sure you're sitting at a pitch table and you're looking at a script and you're talking about making a movie. That's what's interesting about it.
Well, another review that I read that was great was Ebert was talking about this movie, and he said that he loves this movie, but my favorite thing about this movie, despite how good it is as an action movie and blah, 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 is that when you leave the theater, it gives you something to talk about.
Right.
Whether it's the racial issues, whether it's the what you were just talking about with, did they make the right decision, or whether it's just, the feelings being brought up about Russia, the Cold War, and the Cuban Missile Crisis. That is what I love about this movie, is that it's intelligent.
Yeah,
and
completely.
It sparks conversation.
So if you guys have a favorite line, tweet in or leave in the comments. Let's talk about hero-villain ranking.
Surprisingly, they both rank for me.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely, man. Denzel is low. If we can pull mine up. Oh, we got them both. Perfect. I have Denzel at 50th.
Okay.
And the reason that I did that is because once that list gets full, he's going to get bumped off.
Yeah.
And he is the most likely candidate to get bumped off because the people that are right in front of him, like, I still think they're so much cooler than he is. But
yeah.
I still just love this character. I love that his morals. Again, it's exactly what we talked about with what Betsy Sharkey said about Denzel's characters and Tony Scott. That's why he's on my list.
Yeah, he's on my list. He's a little higher. I put him at number 42. I can't think of that many, like, heroes in movies that I love, for instance. Let's just say somebody I have, I think, lower than him is Jack Traven from Speed that I have at number 49. I really like Jack Traven. I think he's a very fun character. He's enjoyable to watch. This is a better character than Jack Traven. Just because I like Speed the movie a lot doesn't necessarily mean that, like, the character's as high as the movie. Whereas this character, I like a lot. He's not memorable in a lot of the ways that some of these great heroes are, but he's very solid.
Yeah.
He's very solid.
He would be on my team. I would pick him. You know what I mean?
Yeah, completely.
Now, Hackman, on the other hand, if you pull up our villains...
Yeah, he's real sweet.
He's a lot higher on yours than he is on mine.
Yeah.
And I just love him, though.
He's great.
So good. Like, I have him at 18. which is moderately high.
It's pretty high. You put him one behind Bodhi, though. I appreciate that.
Yeah, I did. I knew that I would never hear the end of it. But he's not intimidating at all when he hits Denzel in the face twice and Denzel doesn't flinch. Not only is that a sweet fist pump moment, he's just not intimidating.
No.
He's just like an angry old man, but he does slightly redeem himself at the end of the film.
Totally, yeah.
And he's just he's doing what he thinks is right.
He's honorable. When I looked at mine, I was like, okay, so Ivan Drago is like a very entertaining villain from the point of view that he's, you know,
he's so cardboard.
Yeah, he's like an awesome, like, just a villain to be a villain. And, you know, like, okay, Commodus, who's like really awesome, like, love Commodus. He's not likable to me.
Just stop talking.
So this guy falls in an interesting category where, like, Tommy Conlon is more intimidating and he's more memorable to me in some ways. Like, the movie's more memorable and he's a big part of it. But Captain Frank Ramsey is like, he's like a really, really great character. He's a great character more than he's a great villain. Right?
Absolutely.
He's the villain, but he's a great character.
I mean, it's exactly like with, as you can see at the bottom of Ben's list, what he thinks of Sam Gerard, which I just added on my list.
Totally fucking
sweet. Probably should do that at some point.
You just decided to leave my comment and add him to your list?
Well, I added him to my list last week, but your comment's so sweet, I just want to leave it there.
Yeah, I'll take that. I'll take that. All right, where do you put the movie on the all-time list?
I was a little confused. This one, mine's a lot lower than yours.
Gotcha.
I have it at number 27, I believe, and it's after Face Off, but in front of John Wick.
Okay.
And
after Face Off, in front of John Wick.
Yeah, the reason that I did this is because a lot of the times when I come in, because this is, again, it's a combination of our greatest and our favorites, and a big part of that for me is rewatchability.
Yeah.
I love this movie. I really enjoyed it. I would probably watch it over, like, 90% of the time over all the movies that it's in front of.
Yeah.
But I could never want to watch it over Face Off or Rogue Nation, I don't think. Like, if I had only seen all of them once, I would pick those two movies over this one.
I would say this. I saw Crimson Tide for the first time probably 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't watch it growing up. This wasn't on my list. Maybe it was 3 years ago. I watched it again maybe a year ago and then again now. So I've seen it 3 times. And I've enjoyed it more each time I've watched it. This time in particular, I was just like, God, this movie's sweet.
Yeah, from the first time to this time, I literally enjoyed it probably like 100 times more.
And so that's why when I was looking at this list and I was thinking about the movies to put it ahead of, it was like, okay, I can't put it ahead of – it was that and Man on Fire were like toss-ups.
Right. I'm glad that it didn't pass Man on Fire.
What I want to do is I want to watch Man on Fire again, and I want to see how it makes me feel watching it again, because I think some of Man on Fire, some of its action seems sort of frivolous.
Right.
The thing is that the relationship in Man on Fire between him and Dakota Fanning
is
so great, and his – that's why I think Man on Fire is just a touch of – I think it's a better movie. And then the movies ahead of that, it's like Predator and MI3, Bourne Identity. It's not going to pass those. You know, Last Samurai, it's right on the level. It's one ahead of Samurai for me. Tombstone is much more flawed. Tombstone, though it has sweet performances, the movie itself is not as good. Speed is campier. Like,
the performances in this movie are so good.
They're really good.
Yeah.
Totally. So, I put it pretty high. I put it number 16. All right.
Should we do it?
So this is the section of the show where we take the movie, we move it to another era. So this is a 1995 movie. We're going to move it to modern day. If you were to remake this film and recast some of the major roles, who would you recast those roles with? The hashtag for this is hashtag master recaster. You let us know who you think did the best job. You tweet at us. Let us know. We'll tweet back at you. Once again, the Twitter is at AMA Podcast. I'm at Ben Bateman Media, and this is at Andrew Guy. Let's get into it. Let's start with recasting.
And I'm at Andrew Guy.
Very good, sir. All right, then.
All right, then.
Let's start with Viggo. Viggo Mortensen.
I went with...
Sweaty Viggo.
Sweaty Viggo. I love that. I love that how much everyone's sweating in this movie. Yeah. Mr. Taylor Kitsch.
Oh, very solid.
I like it because I think he's got that sincerity about him.
Yeah.
Because the whole time Viggo's a badass. But then when you question his morals, he sticks to his guns.
Completely.
And I can see Kitsch doing that.
Yeah, I love Kitsch. I'm a big fan. I went with Armie Hammer.
I don't dislike that at all.
Yeah.
I just haven't seen him do enough to where I'm like, oh, I want to watch him do this.
I think I could see him handling the sort of like the moral, like you want to believe he's a good guy,
right?
Based on the way his sort of the way he looks, his posture, his jawline,
the looks that Denzel gives him.
Yeah,
the first time when he overturns him.
And, yeah, he's a little like Viggo's like a little bit less sort of a leading man by the general. I mean, I don't know. He's just less of a leading man.
Mm-hmm.
Armie Hammer's like a very handsome dude. So, but I think he would handle this. I think he would hammer. That doesn't work. I think he would handle this role really well.
Oh, I see what you're trying to do there.
Hammered.
That's a shame. That's a shame that you did that on live air. Doesn't his name sound like he should be like a James Dean era actor? Armie Hammer.
He does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Completely. All right. So for Gandolfini, who is, I just love that like. 90% of Gandolfini in this movie is cut to him making a sinister face.
Totally.
Just like looking like a douche.
Just looking angry. He's such a good brute.
He's brooding, a brooding brute. I went with Gleason because we did Troy last week and I just think about Brendan Gleason. He has a really good like angry face.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to think of a movie it's in Mission Impossible 2.
Yeah.
When he's like the doctor and he gets kidnapped and all that. I think he'd kill it as Gandolfini in this.
I think for me, Gleason, the issue I would have with Gleason at this point is that I think when you go with a Navy or a military movie, people's ranks based on their age have to be kind of – otherwise they've been the same –
like idiots.
Yeah, like you can't respect them because they're too old for their rank.
Right.
And I think Gleason, compared to the age of a lot of the other cadets and the other seamen, I think he would be a little too old for the role.
I feel like Gandolfini's like that guy that's never going to move up or down, though. He's just happy being in the middle. Because
he's kind of a brute. He's kind of a dick.
Yeah.
So maybe he's like he just likes to follow the captain. And
yeah.
I could see that. Yeah, Gandolfini incidentally has a great role in True Romance the year before and then shows up again as the mayor in Taking a Pill 1-2-3. So he clearly was someone that Scott liked to work with and you know
RIP. Oh, he's great as the mayor and Taking. I always forget that
he's great.
I'll ride the train. I'll get there faster.
RIP. RIP. All right, I went with Vincent D'Onofrio for Gandolfini.
And who do you have to thank for that?
I have to thank our engineer Mark. It was a fantastic selection.
That's a really good one.
Yeah.
It's really, really good.
You came up with that off the cuff, man.
Yeah.
I was like all right, I need a suggestion, and you're just like D'Onofrio. I was like, okay, thank you. You cannot take this ship from our captain. You hurt her.
For those of you that don't know, Daredevil's coming out March 18th, season 2. Really excited about that.
Vanessa.
All right, so Cobb, what is he called?
Captain, what is he called? Not captain of the ship. He's not the captain.
No, he's not the captain.
Head of the ship?
Something. I'll look it up after I give mine. So mine is someone that most of you guys are not going to know who he is, and I had to look up his name. But he plays the chubby, kind of dumb, dim-witted prison guard in Orange is the New Black, and his name is Joel Marsh Garland. And I just like looking at him and looking at Cobb, because Cobb isn't intimidating. He's a little chubby, but there's something about him and his morality that is...
Chief of the boat. That's what it's called.
Chief of the boat. That's what it is. There's something about the way that this guy plays Cobb that, like, you don't really like him.
Yeah.
But you respect him and you understand him.
Yeah. When Denzel says, he's like, thank you, Cobb. And he's like, fuck
thank
you.
Thank you.
Fuck you.
Yeah. Yeah.
I did what I did because it's right.
Yeah.
You could be wrong. Yeah.
It's a great line. That's actually a really great line.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Joel Marsh Garland, if you guys don't know who he is, look him up and you'll know exactly who I'm talking about.
Yeah. 100%. I went with Kevin Dunn, the man I just mentioned, the principal in Warrior, the dad in Transformers.
I love that.
Yeah, I like Kevin Dunn a lot. I think he'd be a great Cobb. I think Cobb's the kind of, because you're chief of the boat, you're pretty senior.
Could you see Kevin Dunn standing up to Hackman?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. Yeah, I love Kevin Dunn. I'm such a fan of his. It's Kevin Dunn and then Mike Rispoli, who is the other guy who's in Unstoppable, and he's also in Taking? He's in Taking Film 1-2-3. That's
right.
What it is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's like the kind of like the chief or whatever who's like handling the affairs. He's another guy that I think could play the role well.
That's a good one. I love my Hackman recast.
All right.
I went with Tommy Lee Jones.
It's super solid.
It's good, right?
Yeah, real solid.
It's just, I can just picture him saying every single one of those lines.
Can you guess who mine is?
Who is it?
Just take one guess.
I don't know. Tom Cruise.
Wilkinson.
Wilkinson!
Wilkinson!
Father told me, your father begged for his life.
Like a dog.
Like a dog.
Yeah. Love Wilkinson to no end.
Like, I love Wilkinson.
One of my all-time favorite actors.
Yeah, I can't even though I think Tommy Lee Jones is better, yeah. I love Tom Wilkinson so much I don't even care.
Yeah, I've gone with Wilkinson a few times, but he plays evil well, and he's aged enough that I think he's at the correct age to play the role.
That'd be perfect. There's reasons we use these people over and over.
Yeah.
They're so good at what they do, and I'm going to use – okay, so I had this – we talk about in recasting and about like casting young and old and fat and black and white and how you don't always have to follow the whatever word I'm looking for of the original film. In this one, I thought it'd be kind of cool if you swapped the roles and you made it like an old black captain with a young white like hothead.
Yeah.
And then you were able to find the racial tension there.
Yeah.
but I couldn't think of people that were good enough. So I had to go to – I went with Elba.
Yeah.
Idris Elba for Washington, because
awesome.
I think that Mackie's too young. I think that Michael B. Jordan's too young. And then the other guys that are in that same age range, I'm not huge. I mean, I'm not fans of, but yeah. I see Elba. I see Elba and Tommy Lee Jones yelling at each other and having that, you will not give that up. They know that, yeah, moment. Like, I think that'd be sweet.
100%. And I think the reason that it's so important to keep the white captain and the black XO in this movie, we talk about sometimes how when you gender shift or you race shift for a movie, it doesn't affect the recast. This is a movie where the script expressly is written in a certain way. And even if you're going with today's military versus 1995's military, I don't think it really makes that much of a difference.
No.
You still have a bunch of old white guys with medals and money. And no matter how evolved a society or a military we have, you will still have racial tension with a younger, not white officer. It will just happen. I mean, even if it's not as pronounced, you could still write the story and it would still seem the same way. So that's why I think it's important to keep the characters within their correct race for a recast.
Yes.
Otherwise, I think the story changes. I went with, is it Chiwetel Ejiofor?
Yeah.
From 12 Years a
Slave. Love that guy.
He's just a great actor.
It's a good cast.
Children of Men, I mean, he's the right age.
I love Children of Men so much.
Shout out to Mark for another suggestion. Thank you.
Yeah. So if you want to give the Mass Recaster to Mark this week, you can also do that. that's good. I think we did pretty great with those. Those were great recasts.
Yeah, I like it a lot for sure. Cage versus Cruz, I want to do it.
Yeah.
What role in this if Denzel, you can't do it though. Rob, you can't do Cage or Cruz for the Denzel role. You can't do neither one of them could have played Hackman because they were too
I didn't know that. But they are from Portugal.
Yeah, so, something like that. I guess if you were to make the movie now and you put like a stupid mustache on Cruz and you were to like you make him look a little older, he could maybe play like the cap. He could maybe Hackman's role.
Make him look like an old version of who he was in the what was that movie? The Hitler movie.
All
dressed up, yeah.
Yeah, in Valkyrie.
Yeah.
All right, fair enough. It's covered.
Look, Cage versus Cruz isn't going anywhere. Okay, yeah. We're going to force it in whenever we can. all right, man. So this is very interesting to me, and we got our categories. I want you to lead into it.
What if Cage played Gandolfini's role? He's lost his nerve.
I'm into that.
All right, which of the three categories this movie fits into? There are three action movie categories. As we always say, there is totally legitimate, which is a movie like The Fugitive or a movie like, we've said, Die Hard. Movies that are of very high quality, they're compelling, they stay together the whole time. You don't laugh unintentionally. Mm-hmm. True classics. There are totally ridiculous movies, movies like Face Off, movies like Con Air, movies that they fall apart more than you'd think. They're still compelling, you love them, but they're just absurd and hilarious in an awesome way. Doesn't make them any less watchable. It's just they don't feel like they're grounded in reality. Not from like a storytelling standpoint, like there's aliens or this is a Terminator.
Right.
Much more in the standpoint of like, in the scene emotionally, that would never happen. Or like, how did it even get from here to here? Like, what?
Or like, you know, put the bunny back in the box.
Yeah, intentional funny lines. And then you have Ridiculously Legitimate, which is the middle category. The middle category where it's a movie that is driven by compelling drama and great performances, usually mixed with some element of ridiculous or campiness. There's some unintentional laughs, but movies that some people will consider, they'll say something like, oh, that's a great movie.
Right.
But it's a classic. And you're like, ah, it's pretty silly, but I mean, I'll give it to you. It's a classic, but it's not a classic like you're talking like Heat's a classic.
It's like me when I talked to Ben about Con Air the first time. He's like, are you sure? And I was like, no, trust me.
It's a great film. Those are the three categories. Where do you think this movie fits, Andrew?
Totally legitimate.
100%?
100%. Like, I'm sitting here the whole time we were talking about the show and the movie, and I've been sitting here thinking about it because I didn't know what category to put it in.
Yeah, yeah.
It's totally legit, man. Like, there's nothing about it. There's no moments where I'm laughing and I'm not supposed to. It's compelling. It's well acted. It's believable. Like, in the struggles, the racial struggles, and then, like, is Denzel right? Is Hackman right? You know, everything. It's all there. It makes you think. It's enjoyable. I love this movie so much, and there's none of that campiness that doesn't ruin it, but you know what I mean? Changes what it is.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
I go totally legit. Yeah, because I look for the unintentional laughs. They're not there.
I know.
I look for the massive, massive plot holes where I'm like, this is so stupid. They're not really there. It's heavy-handed, but it's heavy-handed no different than a movie like Jerry Maguire's heavy-handed.
Right.
Where, like, it's a great drama. People love that movie. It's an Oscar-nominated film, and people – I still regard it that way, even though it's a silly, campy movie starring Tom Cruise.
Mm-hmm.
This is, like, a product of its environment. It's a 90s Jerry Bruckheimer movie, but it's starring two of the great actors of its time – and
of all time, yeah.
I mean, and it's a great supporting cast. I mean, it's excellent. So I go totally legitimate. I think it's incredible. That wraps it up
for Crimson Tide. Today's
show.
Yeah.
But we have one more thing to do today, and that is called The Pitch.
Boom.
Boom.
Love it.
This is the section of the show where we're going to pitch a movie for you guys for next week. And it is your duty to go to our Twitter, at AMA Podcast, which I've mentioned a billion times, and vote on the movie and let us know which one you want to think we should do next week. We usually put the Twitter poll up right around the time we finish the episode, and it's live until for 24 hours. So if you guys go and find that Twitter and you vote, that'll be the movie we do next week.
And hopefully it'll be the one that you picked.
Yeah, so do you want to go first?
I'm going first, and I'm not giving up. So I already mentioned – okay, so I don't know how many of you guys saw the Jason Bourne trailer this week, this last weekend for the Super Bowl, but a little man named Tommy Lee Jones is in it, and it looks sweet. So it made me all pumped about Tommy Lee Jones again, and I'm not giving up on Under Siege, people. I'm not going to do it. I want it on the show. I want Seagal. I want Busey, and I want Tommy Lee Jones.
Incredible trifecta.
Incredible trifecta, and I want to hear Tommy Lee Jones doing this, his like weird groaning, grunting, screaming sound. And we haven't done a Seagal movie yet on the show. So if you guys want Under Siege, we could do it next week. Let's talk.
Now, my vote is not as classic, but still very sweet.
Very sweet.
The trailer for London Has Fallen has now dropped. Gerard Butler saving the president. This time, it's a group of world leaders. Now, we're pitching the original film, Olympus Has Fallen. You guys may remember Olympus Has Fallen and White House Down came out the same right at the same time. Most people think they're the same movie.
I am one of them. Every single time we talk about them, Ben's like, no, that's the other one.
White House Down, not particularly good. Neither is Olympus Has Fallen. But Olympus Has Fallen is extremely sweet.
It's our show.
Yeah. That movie is like a modern-day retelling of the classic genre that we like to talk about on the show. It's like one dude who's like kind of like, oh, man, I protected the president.
Like washed up.
Yeah, and he's like, oh, I made a mistake, but the president still really respects me. Now he's in trouble, and I have to save his life by killing all these terrorists in the White House. And there's a shit weasel, just like there is in Air Force One,
yep,
who, like, turns on him, and he has to save the president's kid. It's like, it's just sweet. He's got, like, a troubling relationship with his nurse girlfriend, who's like, I thought we were going to the movies this weekend. And he's like, I'm sorry, Biddy. I forgot. My mind's in other places.
Who in the fuck is that talking?
That's Gerard Butler.
All right. You just made me more excited to see Olympus
Has Fallen
than
it's
anyone
super sweet.
Ever has. So,
Tombstone, Olympus Has Fallen, AMA Podcast.
Not Tombstone. Under Siege.
Under Siege. Olympus Has Fallen. Point Break, Point Break. Go to the Twitter and vote on it, guys. Thank you so much for tuning in to yet another episode of Action Movie Anatomy. We're counting down. I think we've only got 8 or 9 episodes left until we do The Rock, the 50th anniversary episode. And thank you all so much. By the time you see us next week, the show will have reached a grand total of 3 million views.
3 million.
It is because of you guys and because how awesome you all are. So thank you so much. Once again, I'm Ben Bateman. You can find me at Ben Bateman Media.
I am Andrew Guy, and you can find me at Andrew Guy on Twitter. And thank you guys so much.
We'll see you next week.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.